Well, we got ourselves a stimulus package. It's an actual real bill, and it's passed by the House. It's on its way to the Senate. It passed last night in the House after a debate, 244 to 188. And that was despite President Obama's attempts at getting bipartisan participation on the bill. Look at the numbers closely. This is President Obama yesterday on Capitol Hill.
What makes an idea sound is not whether it's Democrat or Republican, but whether it makes good economic sense for their workers and companies. And they understand that when it comes to rebuilding our economy, we don't have a moment to spare.
Well, whether he likes it or not, this bill coming out of the House is definitely a Democratic idea. Not a single Republican vote was there at the end when it passed 244 to 188. Chris Hayes joins us. He's the Washington, D.C. editor of The Nation. And Chris Hayes, we've had a couple of discussions about the theory of stimulus. Now we're looking at the practice. What do you see in this bill that's economically sound and particularly something that might answer some of your objections to the way stimulus was talked about in the waning days of the Bush administration?
Well, I mean, stimulus wasn't really taken quite very seriously at all in the waning days of the Bush administration. I mean, it was essentially a pretext for more of the same, which was the tax cuts, which they had always advocated no matter what the situation. So I think the infrastructure spending is not quite as large as I would like to see, but there is in there is very good. The spending that's going to go towards broadband is particularly encouraging, and the green energy stuff. I think the stuff that's in there around weatherization of federal buildings, as boring as that sounds, is actually really, really, really good.
All right, well, explain. You've used really three times there. Why would that be really, really, really good? And I suspect there are some serious jobs behind that.
Yeah, I mean, look, what you want to do is you're in this situation in which there's two imperatives. One is to spend a lot of money to boost aggregate demand and to stop essentially the free fall of the economy and for these really vicious cycles to kick in, which unfortunately have already kicked in. But while you're spending this money, I mean, there's good and bad ways to spend it. At a certain level, you can do what Keynes suggested back when he first started talking about this kind of spending, which is, you know, stick dollar bills inside bottles and throw them down coal mine shafts. And that would have some stimulative effect because it would induce a certain amount of demand and activity, but that wouldn't necessarily bear any long-term fruit in terms of investment.
Right, Chris. I mean, I know all that, and that's not because I'm trying to be Mr. Smarty this morning, but I would love to know, and this is what I yearn for when I look at these places in the bill where they talk about specific earmarked projects, of how it does break down, how much of the material that would be bought is American material, weather stripping for federal buildings, for
sure.
Instance. How much of the contracting jobs would have to be done locally and bring in people who are already unemployed and feeling some distress? Can you help me with that?
Well, no, I mean, I can't. I mean, partly because it's a very, very long bill that passed yesterday, and I haven't read the whole thing in fine-grained detail. I do think that in the Senate, Sherrod Brown has this Buy American provision, which I think is probably going to come to the floor in an amendment. And in terms of these construction jobs, I mean, the reason they're good from a stimulative perspective is this: A, they're labor-intensive, and B, they can't be outsourced. So there's not going to be any kind of leakage there. Look, the devil's going to be in the details in terms of how the contracting happens, and I think that that's a place where there has to be a lot of transparency and follow up, particularly by journalists, to make sure that, you know, massive conglomerates aren't getting these contracts because they're politically favored, or make sure they're paying prevailing wages, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure, sure. Well, who controls that? I mean, is that like the governor in a particular state has a fund that's overseen by some state agency?
Yeah.
At the federal level, is it the General Accountability Office?
It depends, actually. I mean, part of the thing is that the actual money, the funding streams are incredibly complicated and diverse. I mean, some of them are funding streams expanding what are already existing programs. Some of those existing programs are federal programs in which contracting procurement is overseen by the federal agency that is tasked with running that program. Some of them are state-federal partnerships in which money is passed through to the state, and essentially the state decides how the money gets spent. And some of them are new programs. So there's going to be a new bureaucratic edifice that's going to have to be erected,
right,
to make sure that the money goes in the right place.
Well, that could be troublesome. Let's talk about the broadband issue. It sounded like you were really crowing about the idea of broadband infrastructure. How much would broadband upgrades throughout the country and a kind of a Koreanization of mm-hmm. America in some sense to create the broadband like exists in places in East Asia, be like rural electrification in the 1930s, where the idea of electricity in certain rural areas was thought as kind of superfluous, but became a real cultural binding force for the United States.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of took the analogy right out of my mouth. I think it would be, tremendously important. It's really remarkable.
I guess I am trying to be Mr. Smarty here, and I should just shut up. All right, go ahead, Chris.
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think it would be tremendously good for the American economy, and particularly for areas that have seen, particularly areas that are rural, and also areas that have been rapidly deindustrialized, in which, you know. People, I think your listeners listening right now in large metro and urban areas perhaps don't quite realize how sparse broadband access is in large swaths of particularly rural areas in America. And, you know, essentially at this point it is become sort of just a threshold feature of being part of the kind of modern economy.
Right. Let's shift to politics. I deliberately began with the nuts and bolts, even as little as we know about them, because this is only the House bill. But the Republicans have made a deliberate decision that their fingerprints aren't on this at all. Are they taking a risk here?
Yeah, it's essentially an all-in bet. And I don't necessarily think it was kind of the only play they had politically. I mean, look, if you're the Republicans, if things get better and the stimulus is to have thought to work, to whatever sense that is, you're not going to get a ton of credit as a group for voting for it. I mean, it's still going to be Barack Obama's bill. It's still going to be a Democratic Congress. What your only hope is that it fails, and you could then say, I told you so. And so,
but there's something so disheartening about that. I mean, from my perspective as a person in the media, I'm wondering if the ubiquity of the media now, unlike what was the case during the 1930s, demands that there be an opposition that is diametrically opposed to what the prevailing authorities are doing. And so it raises the profile of people who, back in the FDR days, might have sort of gone along and been part of some urgent national movement to deal with a crisis.
That might be true. I think part of it also is just the fact that there's been two things. One is that, you know, when FDR was passing things in the very, very beginning of his administration, what would be, you know, essentially correlated to the time period we're in now, the crisis in the country was far more acute. I mean, it was much more like that week after Lehman failed that he was operating in which we saw, you know, the 83 senators voting for the TARP. So
right.
There was more an acute sense of panic. I mean, he had to declare a bank holiday, there were bank runs, et cetera, et cetera. Second of all, I think there has been an interesting shift in the culture of Capitol Hill during the Bush years into what sort of resembles a kind of quasi-parliamentary system in which legislators see in the minority, particularly the Republicans, have really kind of coalesced around this notion of party unity and party line votes, and kind of marshal their power. They try to leverage it as a block, as a party, in a way that's actually fairly unique and distinct in the history of American legislative politics. And the interesting question is whether the Democrats figure that out and act accordingly, or they still sort of comport themselves under the old rules.
And of course, the Senate behaves very, very differently. And
exactly.
We're going to see different kinds of arguments and a lot more cooperation. What do you expect, first of all, in terms of the nature of the debate, and then the kinds of things that are going to be in the Senate bill that are going to have to be reconciled later?
Well, it's going to be a totally different debate. I mean, because you know you're going to have a sort of batch of Republican senators who might actually vote for the bill, and that's going to create a totally different set of terms around what the negotiating principles are. With the House Republicans, it was always fairly clear that A, it was going to pass whether they liked it or not, and B, they probably weren't going to vote for it. In the Senate, it's a whole different story. I think in the Senate, you're going to see much less these sort of ideological shibboleths that you saw from the House Republicans, and more kind of narrow geographic and regional concerns. So I think you're going to see the senators, the Republican senators, say Susan Collins and Olympia Snow from Maine, possibly Voinovich from Ohio, who kind of push more sort of narrower regional interests into the stimulus in trying to make sure they kind of get theirs in
right.
Rather than this kind of ideological war against government spending.
Well, Chris Hayes, before we go, and there's so much to talk about on this, I just wanted to ask you, something we're asking our listeners this morning, and that is, you know, have you seen a giant sale in your neighborhood? Have you gotten anything for 70% off? Have you?
You know, I bought a suit really cheap recently.
How cheap?
It was about, I don't know. It was marked down around 60%, somewhere in there, somewhere in the neighborhood of that.
So it was a $100 suit?
Yeah, it was around $150, yeah.
And what's your normal, what do you normally pay?
Oh, God, normal. I don't own that many suits. So
quickly.
You know, somewhere around $300.
All right. Chris Hayes, finding deals in Washington, D.C. as editor of The Nation. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, John.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.